Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Barbara Dana. She is an actress. She's the author of several books, including two on Emily Dickinson, Wider Than the Sky, which is essays and meditations on the healing power of Emily Dickinson, and A Voice of Her Own, which is a novel imagining Emily Dickinson's life. And on Saturday, May 30th, she will be doing a reading and book signing at Garcia Street Books at 10:30 in the morning. And then she will be in Los Alamos at 1:30 in the afternoon at Ottawa Station. Welcome, Barbara, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm so glad to be here.
So how did you get interested in the life of Emily Dickinson? You immersed yourself in her life and in her poetry.
Well, I did, and I spent actually 10 years on this book, so I really had to care because it's a long time. Well, I think the main reason is the inner strength of her and the inner strength of a young woman. This book concentrates on her young life from the age of 9 to 24, going from childhood into adulthood, and the journey of keeping that young, spunky voice. She was very, very spunky as a kid, and remained spunky internally. I mean, as she grew with a lot of struggles to hold on to her way of doing things, her destiny, her dream, very tough, but she did, and it's kind of tracks that journey, and I'm very interested in that. The book I did prior to that was a novel based on the young life of Joan of Arc, who is, you know, kind of the archetype of that, of a young girl having a strong inner sense of what's true for her, and all around her, no one seems to share that, but her and her struggles in being true to what that is. So I think that was a big thing that interested me in Emily. And above that, I don't know. I just really love her.
Let's talk about her life for a moment. She was born in 1830 in Amherst, Massachusetts, and she ended up living a very introverted and, as they say, kind of reclusive life. Tell us about her life and development.
Well, she was born in Amherst. Her father was a very respected lawyer in the community. He was in politics. He was in the House of Representatives in Washington for, I believe it was 1 year. He was in the state government serving in Massachusetts, and he had a very successful law practice. She had a older brother, Austin, who is 2 years older, and a younger sister, Lavinia, 2 years younger. Her mother was, well, pretty much all we need to say about the mid-1800s in New England is that she was a wife, quote, and that was another, women really did nothing much but be the wife and helpmate to the husband and his home, and nothing else, nothing in addition to that. And she was, her mother was suffered depressions, anxieties. She was had a lot of hypochondria. Her father was extremely remote and yet very dictatorial, so it was an interesting combination. He held the family very close. His way was the way things were to be done, but he wasn't there much. And even when he was there, he was kind of remote. So that was an interesting family dynamic.
So what was it like for somebody of so much passion, talent, and vision to grow up in 19th century New England where women didn't get to really express that?
It was horrendously hard. Now, I took it from, like, now, for me, to have my own voice and be true to express a lot of the things that I want to do creatively is still been an issue for me, and I think it is for some women even today. But if we look back to the 1800s in Puritan New England, it was a huge difficult thing for her. She was very spunky as a kid, with a lot of girlfriends, boyfriends, parties, dances, sleigh rides, maple sugaring, very funny, and as very close to the girlfriends. And as she entered, she came back from Mount Holyoke, where she was in college for a year, Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, it was called at that time. Now it's Mount Holyoke College. She was beginning to feel that separation from her girlfriends, who were all taking the more traditional route of concentrating only on who they would marry, how soon they would marry, and if they could marry someone and be the wife of a missionary, that was really the best thing. And it was really all-consuming in those days, and that's all you did. There were very few women. There were some women writers then, but very, very few. It was not highly thought of. It began to be highly thought of that women be educated. That was starting, but not that they used it for anything. And her inner fire, like a volcano, was calling out to her to fulfill her destiny as she began to be aware of it in her childhood and later childhood. It grew and grew. And how was she going to pursue this in the face of it wasn't done? It just wasn't done. And her father was very against it.
And so, actually, I was wondering if you might want to read a poem or two. Probably many of our listeners know Emily Dickinson's work, and many of them don't. And so to give people a sense of the intensity and what would you call distilled nature of some of her work, I think would be wonderful. Do you have any favorites that you'd like to read?
Oh, wow. Well, I, picking them is hard. I better find my book. I know a lot of them by heart because I'm doing The Belle of Amherst, which is a play about her. There's a lot of her poetry in it, and I have to learn it all. Here's one that hit me like a ton of bricks. I was going through a really difficult time in my life, and it was when I really got close to her was during this time. It was about 12 years ago, and things had been a certain way in my life, and for years and years and years, and that's the way I thought it would be, and suddenly it was actually my marriage, my family life in that marriage broke apart, and that was something I never questioned. And suddenly what I mostly thought was a given wasn't there, and it was a very tough time for me. And I couldn't really, for a while, feel anything. I mean, I didn't even know, I couldn't figure out why I should get up. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, God, I can't get out of bed today. It was just like, I just didn't see why. It didn't make sense to me. I was numb. And I didn't think that anyone understood me. And this poem, I read this poem, and it kind of cracked me open emotionally. To try to remember it by heart. I cautious scanned my little life. I winnowed what would fade from what would last till heads like mine should be a dreaming laid. I put the latter in a barn. The former blew away. I went one winter morning, and lo, my priceless hay was not upon the scaffold, was not upon the beam. And from a thriving farmer, a cynic I became. Whether a thief did it, whether it was the wind, whether deities guiltless, my business is to find. And so I ransack. How is it hearts with thee? Art thou within the little barn love provided thee? And that just cracked me open, that somebody knew what I was going through, that someone had expected things to be a certain way. The one thing that they were surest of is suddenly gone.
Right, right. Well, there's a couple of things that speaks to, and one of them is you edited this whole book on the healing power of Emily Dickinson's work.
Yes, and I wanted to mention, Mary Sharp, that I co-edited it. My wonderful
right.
co-editor is Cindy McKenzie, who is a Dickinson scholar from Canada. So we did that together, and we each also have essays in the book.
Right, and because the work, the Dickinson work, is so cognizant of pain and the abyss, and probably the word existential hadn't been coined yet, but sense of this terrible nothingness, just simply knowing that somebody else understands that and can articulate it better than you can is in itself kind of a healing power.
Tremendous. I mean, I don't know. I think it may be true for a lot of people, but for me, a big, big, what made my pain and my difficult situation even worse was this fact, this knowledge, I would call it, that I was filled with, that I was alone, that nobody really knew what I was feeling. And I have such wonderful friends and family, and they would say, it's going to get better. You're stronger than you think. Time heals all these things. And they were, I don't know if time by itself heals it, but it can help. They were actually right, but my feeling was that they were very sweet. They were being very, very supportive, but they didn't actually know what was going on with me, or they wouldn't say that. So I just felt alone. I didn't feel seen. And the fact that someone can articulate pain, not just to describe it intellectually, but to, in a way that you know they've been there right where you are, you know it. It just is a very, for me, was a very, very healing thing.
I think another really important point that you bring up in your work is the presence of death and pain seems to be more present in perhaps in the whole 19th century, perhaps in the whole era before, you know, painkillers and antidepressants and antibiotics and the many comforts that we take for granted. Pain was the norm, was the mainstream, was acknowledged, and she gave voice to it in a way that's kind of hard for us to do now, because at least in American culture, it's kind of expected that your life be good and nice.
Yes, I think that's a very interesting point. And it was not so true then. And death, I mean, we live with a lot of, God knows, death now. But for let's say Amherst in the 1800s, people were dropping like flies from tuberculosis, for instance. Mainly, and a lot of things. Emily's house, her growing up house from the age of 5 to 24, the ages that I center on in my book, her house was right on the town cemetery, bordered this cemetery. And outside her window every day would be burials and passive people that she knew, school friends, one after the next. And to try and really make sense of that, she really did a lot of thinking, and it tapped a lot of knowledge inside her, maybe inside all of us deep, that she was sensitive enough not to cover over, of questions about death and the sense that we don't live forever, which is there's a wonderful verse in her poem that inspired me. The last verse of a poem, and I'm forgetting the first line at the moment, but it's, my sickness, was it loss or that ethereal gain one gathers measuring the grave, then measuring the sun? Which I find very inspiring. You know, a lot of times you'll go through an illness or a depression or whatever, and can come out of it stronger, because you've allowed yourself, been able to go there and go through it, and it's more than appreciate the good. It's more of a just being in a place where you're not blotting out death.
We're talking to Barbara Dana about the life of Emily Dickinson. There's one that I memorized a while back that really doesn't have any hopefulness at all, but I love it. Can I say it?
Please.
It goes like this. The heart asks pleasure first, and then excuse from pain, and then those little anodynes that deaden suffering, and then to go to sleep, and then if it should be the will of its inquisitor, the privilege to die.
How about that?
There's no light at the end of that tunnel.
No. And it's not really, except that it is a graphic inner piercing of what we can feel sometimes. It's a graphic sense of what that feels like, and the sense that someone can feel that and still be alive and write about it.
Exactly.
Is to me also inspiring.
So you work with young people, you work with girls and bring Emily Dickinson's work to them. You're doing something here in Santa Fe, you do stuff all over the place. What? Tell us about that work with young people.
Well, I'm very interested in this issue of young people maintaining their own voices, and I think it's a lot of it is personally because it's been hard for me to do and something that's meant a lot to me to do. And I think it's a very tricky time, and I'm sure it is for boys as well as girls. I just have a personal experience with a girl going through it. And the time of the spunkiness and spirit of girls and the enthusiasm and all kinds of different things. And I think still, I think even today still, that there's a real danger of that being deadened, and a sense coming, trying to navigate adolescence and hold on to that and not just fall into, you know, well, how can I, you know, be like the other girls, or how can I marry the right person, or how can I be what that pretty enough, or how can I have the right figure, or how can I, all these things that can dampen the individuality of this girl. It's so tragic to me. And so, I know there are workshops and groups around now that are feeling as I do about this and want to help to give girls, help girls with a sense of their self-esteem, a sense of their originality and enthusiasm and taking risks and appreciating themselves and their bodies. A lot of these things that actually Girls Incorporated kind of stresses. And I think girls need strong role models. I bet boys do too. I'm being a girl, having been a girl, now a woman, I think about that very strongly. And I think they need strong role models, which is why the book on Joan of Arc, I think, also sparked me. So I'm thinking these workshops, they're involved with exploring. There's several scenes in my book of Emily at this point in her adolescence and struggling with feeling different from the way her girlfriends are feeling and going, and feeling this need to express her originality and her, and be a writer and maybe not even get married. I mean, that was a horrific thought in those days. And there's a couple of scenes, few scenes in the book that way, and a lot of the workshops will take these scenes and the girls will read different parts with me and with each other. And then it'll open it up for talks about what that brings up for them, and if any of that and what of that is true for them, or things that they might worry about and how they might like to deal with it. It's kind of a leaping off point.
I mean, it is a kind of an irony that this work, which is used and which you consciously use for exploration and healing and so on, Emily Dickinson didn't even share with anybody. It was all poems stuck on scraps of paper in a drawer.
Yes. She did share some of the poetry in letters. She was a prolific letter writer, and there's a huge volume of her letters, which is enormously helpful as research. I lived with those letters. I read them every day solidly for 2 years, and constantly off and on since, where she connected with friends and would often include a poem in those. But other than that, no, she sewed her poems into little hand-sewn booklets called fascicles, and she put them in the bottom drawer of her bureau. And she would, as you say, she'd have these scraps of paper during the day, and she'd have to do the things of helping to run the house and all the work, and then at 10 o'clock at night, she'd go up with these little scraps and put them in, you know, and write her poetry based on these little scraps and put it in the drawer.
So why didn't she become more public? I mean, was it really that impossible as a woman to be a public poet in the mid-19th century?
It wasn't impossible, but from my understanding of exploring the period, it was difficult. And there were not very many of them. And it was particularly difficult for Emily, not only in the culture, but in her family and her family dynamic with the father. I mean, he was an enormous impressive element of her life, and very dictatorial. She was very tied to him. It was very, she would say, or did say, his heart was pure and terrible, and I think no other like it exists. Very, you know, two-faceted, which is a tough thing to deal with. She was very tied to him and what he would want. He didn't want the daughters to get married. Never heard that he said that, but it was clear. And they didn't.
How odd. Well, I mean, don't, you know, when you think about Jane Austen, I mean, it's a different place, but, you know, don't all parents want to marry their daughters off?
No. I think most do. But, I must say for myself, I could relate to that because I think at the base, my father didn't want me to get married. I mean, I think he would like to have wanted it. But deep down, I think he wanted me to keep me as his little girl.
Right.
And I understand that. And Emily's father used to call her the best little girl in Amherst. And he really, you know, valued her as a little girl. But he didn't want the family to leave home. He didn't want her to have boyfriends and go out on dates and... He was very difficult about that. If she was out 30 seconds past the 9 o'clock curfew, he would come and get her. I don't think he wanted to share his daughters. It's sad, but it happened sometime.
So here you are immersed in the life of Emily Dickinson in a really different way than most people who study her are. Most people who study Emily Dickinson are academics. And there's a nice passage of how you go to these academic conferences and are kind of both intimidated and amazed at the amount of picayune scholarship on the use of the dash in her poetry.
Yes, yes.
Or whatever.
Yeah, that was great. I went to met one scholar, the first meeting I went to, because I'm an actor and a fiction writer, and I've never even gone to college. I'm beginning to come out with that now and say it, but it's been I'm a little bit embarrassed about that, but I'm self-educated, so I was intimidated, but I wanted their knowledge. I wanted to learn more about Dickinson from these other points of view, and first woman I met there, I said, so what are you doing with Dickinson? And she said, well, you know, I'm doing a book on the exploration of the meaning of the dash in Emily Dickinson's poetry between 1861 and 1862.
Heavens.
I mean, and I was like, oh, my God. And she said, and also exploring the possibility that she may have written poetry earlier than we realize. And I said, because the first known poem that exists is one she wrote at 19. So I said, yeah, you know, I have the feeling that she wrote some things earlier. And the look on her face, anyway, the way I interpreted it was like, you have a feeling? You have a feeling? I mean, that's not, what value is that? We want to find out whether she did. It was just coming at Dickinson from just the study of her from different directions. And now I think we've all kind of come, myself and the others in the group, the Emily Dickinson International Society, great group of scholars and lovers of Dickinson. We've kind of, I think, come to the fact, or certainly I have, and maybe they always did, that we just come from study from different ways, you know, but it's the same journey.
Barbara Dana is an actress. She's the author of two books on Emily Dickinson. One is a novel, and one is a, she's actually a co-editor of a book of essays called Wider Than the Sky, Essays and Meditations on the Healing Power of Emily Dickinson. That is a book that kind of runs some, I don't know what, in-between world between academia and people who buy books about healing.
Yes, it does, and that we did that on purpose. I was suggested by my colleague Cindy McKenzie, who is a the Dickinson scholar and professor in Canada, and she had this idea for a book of essays about the healing power of Dickinson's poetry, because she had been helped very much by it, and she knew of other scholars, and she thought we met and we were talking. She mentioned it to me, and the fact that she had contact with scholars who might offer essays on why her poetry might do this, and why in a scholarly manner and a literary manner what might be involved, and that I would have a lot of people that I could bring, actors, writers, painters, poets, who would approach it in a more sensory way. So it is really well balanced, I think. It's really interesting in that way. I think it turned out really, really well, I must say, that it has essays by psychologists. Marion Woodman from Canada has a brilliant, the writer and psychologist has a brilliant essay. Poets, Gregory Orr, painters, scholars, actors. And then we have a group of really well-known people who love her, who have short pieces all the way through. And it's it does bring a lot of different perspectives to the study of why her work might help in healing.
Barbara Dana will be at Garcia Street Books on Saturday, May 30th at 10:30 in the morning, and then she'll be in Los Alamos at Ottawa Station at 1:30 in the afternoon. Barbara Dana, thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Yolanda Nava. She's with the National Hispanic Cultural Center and New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs, and Lois Ellen Frank, who is a culinary anthropologist, food historian, chef, and photographer. And the two of them are co-authors of the book Good Food, Good Health, From Field to Feast Wellness Handbook. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
So this is a stapled sort of long book, what would you call it, long booklet, short book, whatever, with lots of good common sense health information, from food to medicine to lifestyle to stress to various problems that people have. This is an initiative of the National Hispanic Cultural Center, New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs. What was the motivation to have this book, which is being distributed to a lot of people for free?
Well, the motivation was that we were, the National Hispanic Cultural Center and the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center in Albuquerque, were funded to do a collaborative initiative by the New Mexico Community Foundation called From Field to Feast, a celebration of our common culture, food, and agricultural practices. And this initiative began last year, and the programming began last fall. As a result of that, I thought, because I had been involved in health, you know, when I was a broadcast journalist, you know, in California, and I continue to be, concerned about health issues, particularly here in New Mexico, I thought that people, our target audience, are Native Americans and Hispanics because of the two organizations, and I thought we needed to give people tools to help them make healthier choices, because Hispanics and Native Americans are at severely high risk of heart disease, obesity, and diabetes. The situation is really chronic here as well as across the nation for these two groups. So I wanted to give them tools. So I found, I went out, I made the proposal, and I solicited funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for Health Sciences at the University of New Mexico, and they very generously came in as our funder for the first 10,000 copies. And when we went through that batch very quickly, like in about 6 weeks, we then got funding from Conalma and from the Indian Public Cultural Center, who took some of their money for this year to put into the book, and went with another 10,000. We've almost distributed all 20,000 copies of books in English. We now have a 10,000 edition of Spanish that we're going to be distributing at no cost. And the reason we could do it at no cost is because we had the private funding, because they saw the need to get information out into the hands of these two target audiences.
Now, when the book is distributed, do you have any sense that people are reading it? Are you getting feedback? Is there also an interactive component where you're either lecturing or conversing with the people who get the book?
We haven't really had that much interaction beyond, you know, our personal connections. But when I took a couple cases of the book up to Taos Pueblo last fall, and I met with the wellness coordinator up there, and he just said to me, he said, you know, how did you find me? You know, he says, you have no idea how much we're suffering here. And you know, that nobody talks to them. There's no, you know, there's a disconnect. And there's not the information available to, you know, to the people on the Pueblo. And he was very, very grateful.
What kind of suffering are they going through?
Health,
up there?
I mean, particularly diabetes and obesity. And then from those illnesses, you have a whole array of other things which go awry. I mean, it's... you get depression. I mean, there are a lot of problems that are ancillary to, you know, any disease. So that motivated me to present the idea of having a movable feast as well as the feast, because we celebrated a feast in Albuquerque last year with the National Hispanic Cultural Center and the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center, and so I thought, well, why don't we take the feast out into the communities, as funding enables us to do so. So this year we're going to be doing Lois Ellen Frank will be doing a healthy cooking demonstration. We'll have a feast, and then we'll have a nutritional presentation by a nutritionist from UNM.
Now let's talk about the feast. What do you serve?
Well, we're still working out some of the menu details, but I think the concept is to be able to take something that's not hugely expensive, make a menu, and make that available to, let's say, a family of six or a family of eight, and we're going to demonstrate how to do it, and then to use all the parts. For instance, if you make a baked chicken with vegetables, you can then take the chicken carcass and make a delicious stock, which is very nutritious, and then make another meal out of that to feed your family a second time. So we're really trying to look at how to take good food that's healthy food and make it economical for communities that may not have a lot of extra money to spend, and maximize the nutritional value in some of these meals and part of the feast. Mm-hmm.
What are the best ways to maximize your dollars and get really good, healthy food? I mean, obviously, going to some of these very wonderful but very expensive natural food stores isn't going to be the way if you want to stretch your bucks.
Well, I think two components that stick out in my mind. One is eating, going back to what I would call the indigenous foods, or the foods that come from that existed in New Mexico before contact, and then foods that the Spanish brought with them. So a combination between the Native American foods that existed here with the foods introduced and brought by the Spanish. So you have beans, you have corn, you have chilies, squash, all of which are very nutritious, inexpensive. And then a lot of times, if you can reintroduce those seeds and have a small garden and plant those, a lot of those foods will last. Beans will last from one season to the next. I still have pumpkins from last season that I'm using now strictly for seeds, but they'll last. They'll winter over, and the flesh will still be edible all the way into March. And so there's a lot of ways that we can take traditional practices that have existed in New Mexico for literally hundreds, in some cases thousands of years, and bring those foods back. Those are the foods that have kept alive our ancestral elders, and those are the foods that we need to make sure remain alive and are vital and reintroduced into many of the communities throughout New Mexico.
Food is really important, because in the American diet, And we've learned to rely heavily on a lot of fatty foods, a lot of processed foods, a lot of food with additives and chemicals and colorings and all kinds of stuff in it. Too much fat. We eat stuff that's fast food. Fast food is lovely for an occasional event, but some people are relying on it to feed their children every day or to provide a quick dinner at night, and that's not healthy because of the fat content, the poor quality of
And it's also not inexpensive.
No, it's very expensive.
It's very expensive. And yeah. The illusion is that it's not expensive, but when you start adding up the $5, $6, $7, or $8 per person, that's hugely expensive. For that same amount of money, you could have 2, 3, 4 meals that are much more nutritious, much higher in ingredients and vitamins that we need, and much less in fat and sugar.
My mother worked full-time, and she used to prepare dinner every night. I would have dinner on the table, you know, within half an hour. And she always cooked from scratch and fresh, and everything was, you know, natural, fresh vegetables, fruits, and things like that. And when I had my own family, I did the same thing. I didn't rely on, in fact, I've told my husband, I didn't rely on processed foods. I told my husband, I said, you cannot go into the center aisles of the market. If you shop the perimeter, you're going to get your fruits, your vegetables, your meats, you know, your dairy products, the good stuff. When you go into the center part of the market, you get all the frozen and packaged stuff, and that has all the stuff in it. I think another thing that people need to look at is to look at the labels on the back of the packages, which tell you, you know, calorie content, fat content, how much protein, how much fat, how much carbohydrate. And, you know, you can really be bamboozled because you can be thinking you're buying something that's healthy because it's promoted that way on the front of the box, and yet you look at the back and it has 200 fat calories. And that
enough sodium
to,
for yeah. the entire day
yeah.
and
right.
enough sugar for the entire day in that one processed food.
Right, right.
And some of us are alert to this, and even though I've had exposure to this for over 30 years, you know, you get lazy, you forget, you start eating differently. And when we started doing this project and I started reading labels again constantly, I was just flummoxed by how much bad stuff there is in particularly what you think is good food that you're purchasing. Even vegetarian items sometimes has a tremendous amount of fat in it, which, you know, none of us need so much of.
Right, and that's, you know, that's a marketing packaging thing. It says a vegetarian food, but then it's, you know, 80% vegetable fat.
Yeah. So it just takes, you know, being more conscientious. You know, the critical areas for our target audiences has been heart disease, obesity, and diabetes. And the hope is that these three major illnesses, which affect, you know, so many people, are totally preventable. I mean, unless you have a genetic something, and most people don't. It's that diabetes is something that comes on because you're eating incorrectly.
Way too much sugar and fat.
Yeah, too much sugar and fat, too much quantity, not getting enough exercise. And right now our youth groups are really highly at risk because teenage onset diabetes is just soaring. Obesity among the youth population is huge. They just had an article, about a month or so, 2 months ago, about preschool children mm-hmm. who are obese. And, of course, the figures are highest for Native Americans, then Hispanics, and then, you know, the general population. But the idea that little children, 2, 3, and 4-year-olds, are already predisposed to obesity and diabetes is frightening in terms of the long-term consequences, because basically you have about 15 years after, you know, when you get youth onset diabetes, and you're dead potentially because of all the crushing of organs, the damage that's done to your spine. I mean, there's a whole bunch of series of negative effects. So if parents can be more aware that a chubby baby is not a healthy baby, that, you know, that they feed their children differently, that they don't give them the 32-ounce tubs of soda water to start drinking when they're, you know, infants and toddlers, that you start training them differently and they appreciate drinking just water or a bit of natural juice, but drinking more other fluids.
There is a flip side to that I think one has to be careful of, which is that if you feed a baby healthy food, you know, breast milk, and then it grows up and starts to eat regular baby food, some babies really are nice and chubby and round, and they're perfectly healthy, and then you get into this, like, everybody's supposed to be some kind of American ideal of thin.
There's a difference between being round or chubby, if you want to use that term, and obese.
Right.
And I think we're trying to differentiate the difference. When a child is carrying between 50 to 75 pounds of fat, above what is considered normal for that child, they're going to struggle for the rest of their life to keep that weight off. It's just not something that you want to do to a child and then have them fight constantly to get it off. It's a lot easier to prevent it than to take it away.
And
I think that's where we're going.
It starts when you're in the womb and how you're eating when you're pregnant and then how you feed that child afterwards and how you teach them about food. You know, most of us were trained, you know, eat everything on your plate because of the poor, starving, whatever group was referenced, the Armenians, whoever. And so you wanted to eat everything because there was this attitude of scarcity for some of us that were coming with parents who had gone through the Depression. But eating smaller amounts, eating more frequently during the day is healthier for you than one meal or three huge meals. And it does help you speed up your metabolism, and then you can, you know, you can maintain your weight. And then the exercise. Kids have not been having good PE classes, and they're not running and moving. They're sitting down with, you know, computer games or watching television. They really need to get out and hike and work and bicycle and do
garden.
Lots of fiddle garden. Yeah, Lois
well,
can talk about
I
gardening.
I mean, that's there is a way that when you start to put these pieces together, a lot of things in a good way start to fit. For example, you start growing a garden, you start getting back to your indigenous food history, you turn off the television, and you spend more time with your family, you relieve stress. A lot of these things feed back on each other in a very good way.
They're interconnected, absolutely.
Well, cooking is so important because, I mean, you know, I wrote a book, It's All in the Frijoles. It's not a cookbook. It's a book of virtues with Latin twist. But the idea was that I learned all of my life lessons in the kitchen. I'm sure you did too, Lois. And, you know,
not me.
But my mother would cook dinner every night, and on the weekends we would often entertain and have family over. And, you know, while we were baking, you know, she would talk about, you know, why buy the cow when the milk is free, you know, and I got my sex education that way. But cooking is a really wonderful way to teach children your family history, your food history, your culture, to give them wisdom and to pass information on. And you know, the studies have shown that what families who sit down and eat together and talk about
different topics
not only stay together, but the children perform better academically. And allowing your kid to go sit off by himself or herself and watch television and eat or not eat at the table with the rest of the family is not building the kind of social skills and the you know, family tradition skills that make for a good
and
family.
It literally bonds you not only within the family unit but with your community. Food is the one thing, regardless of size, shape, ethnicity, language, that we can all sit down at the same table and do. And we could. Literally, we could have 57 different countries at the same table speaking totally different languages, but we could share the same meal.
Right.
We might not be able to talk about the meal, but we could share the same meal. And so you start to see and celebrate in the diversity that we all share and in some of the characteristics, what makes us who we are and the stories of who we are. And the difference between eating a tree-ripened peach at the peak of the season from Velarde and a candy bar that's been processed and probably sitting on the shelf for a year to a year and a half to 2 years, seriously. And how delicious that peach is, and the story of the family that raised the peach, and the families that settled in the valley, and what they go through. And it's just amazing. And there's nothing like a tree-ripened fruit. There's nothing like harvesting your own corn or going to farmer's market. And I think New Mexico is pretty progressive in the sense that we are going back to these roots and revitalizing them, and it's alive in both communities.
Well, we have to. I mean, you have to have sustainable agriculture. The whole initiative of buying local and supporting, you know, local farmers. We often ship food 1,500 miles or more. We're paying a lot of money for all that transport cost. We're not getting fresh, you know, when's the last time you had a really good tasty peach unless you got it in Velarde or from a local farmer. So we're losing some of the sensory and economic benefits of growing local and supporting our local farmers and ranchers who produce, you know, lamb, chicken, and other products as well.
Now, some people live in first of all, in apartments where they don't have access to ground to plant things in, even if they want to. And then some people
A tomato on a windowsill. Mm-hmm.
You could grow a tomato on a windowsill, and that'll feed you for, you know, a couple of days. But there are also community gardens and seed banks and all sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Santa Fe, there was just an article in the paper saying that they are initiating 3 community gardens where people can sign up and have a plot of land, and depending on which garden, which location, that the water is going to be supplied by the city, which is a phenomenal opportunity for people to do.
That's
and
huge.
It
yes,
is.
It is huge.
And then for Native American communities, Native Seed Search will offer free seeds to get them started in bringing back traditional agriculture, and they're based in Tucson, Arizona. So different Native communities can contact them, and they'll be given seeds. And so and other organizations that can sponsor seeds to get people started. And then what you want to do is save those seeds.
Right.
Because I remember always growing up and, you know, what did you grow? What do you have? And let's trade. And that's one of the first things I think that, you know, that the Chamayo chili seed is so coveted because it's so prized. It's not like any other seed in any other part of the state. And so everybody wants that particular seed as opposed to a seed maybe from the South or from California, which is not going to produce the same chili. And so those are the things that we can keep alive. We would call those heirloom seeds and trade amongst each other and really covet because those are very special. They represent the history of New Mexico.
And even if you go to the supermarket and buy a squash, you can plant those seeds. Even if those squashes aren't from here, they'll probably grow, wouldn't they?
As long as they're not a hybrid. Hybrid plants mean that you genetically have to go back to the parents.
Uh-huh.
So if you bought a squash from Farmer's Market that was an heirloom squash, meaning that the original two parents on both sides, yes, you could plant that and save those seeds from then on.
But
it's only the hybrids that you can't.
But, I mean, if you go to Smith's and you buy a spaghetti squash or something like that, will it grow?
If it's not a hybrid,
yeah,
and,
so you'd
and you'd
have to
ask.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Farmer's Market would probably be a better source for the squash that would have the indigenous seeds.
For seed saving, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we're at such an interesting moment because, on the one hand, there's this whole agribusiness continual winnowing away of diversity toward monoculture in food and everything else. And then you have this explosion of seed banks and this movement to go back to heirloom and indigenous seeds and plants.
Well, it's vital to retain the heirloom seeds and to continue those traditions because the food is hearty, it is more productive. Some of the studies that have misled a lot of the spending for the genetically altered seeds and plants, in fact, are not true. They do not provide for greater productivity for farmers, and that was a selling point to get this stuff into the markets, into the farmers' hands. So, you know, it's about balance, and it's about maintaining what works and what's healthy and what's good for you and what's affordable for the broadest number of people. If we're all dependent on a monotype food culture, we're stuck. You know, I call it global corporate colonialism.
Right.
You know, you're tied and you don't have the freedom to produce for yourself. I've heard stories in northern New Mexico that many of the people there were able to sustain the economic depression of the 1930s because they had a pig, a cow, and they
some
grew
seeds.
Their own feed and some
yeah.
seeds. And
hell,
so you produce
I've
your own food.
I've heard stories of people who say, what depression? Life
yeah.
is just the way it always was.
Yeah, yeah. And it's tight. You know, you don't have a lot of extra money to spend, but you can feed your family. And you can take that soup bone and you can make a soup or a stew or something with it, and you can feed your family.
So it's one thing to talk about it, and there's this wonderful book, Good Food, Good Health, From Field to Feast, Wellness Handbook. It's another thing to take that information and start living your life differently.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of support do people need to actually start implementing both culinary and other lifestyle changes?
I think you start small. You know, you set some goals. You say, I want to try this. And maybe you eat one day a week vegetarian. And then you
including
you know,
your beans and rice.
Including your beans and rice. And you just do it small. You don't try to make all the changes at once. Maybe you start with a few herbs in a pot on your patio or on your porch, and then maybe you put some in the ground and then
reintroduce homemade
yeah.
corn tortillas back into your family, and you get the kids going. We just did a class yesterday where she said, oh, my three-year-old would love this, and the dough and the masa. And you make it an activity. Yeah. You make it something fun. You start to exercise one day a week, and then you go to 2 days a week.
Right.
And so I agree with Yolanda. It's like a pebble in the pond. And you drop the pebble in and you get those little ripples. But when you start to look overall, they ripple out and all of a sudden it's giant and you're totally healthy again. And you wonder, how did I do this or how did I get unhealthy because I feel so great now?
Yeah, and you will feel wonderful. You will feel wonderful when you eat better, when you exercise better, you get rid of depression. Your family is healthier. Your children are going to not be hyper because they're getting too much sugar or food coloring in their foods. I mean, it has a lot of benefits.
Yolanda Nava and Lois Ellen Frank are co-authors of the book Good Food, Good Health, From Field to Feast Wellness Handbook. If somebody wants to get their hands on this book, what should they do?
Well, they can contact me at yolanda.nava@state.nm.us. I don't think I can guarantee getting you English copies because I think we're about out of our 20,000, but I do have Spanish language copies. We just got a run of books in Spanish, so those are available. But it would be interesting to know how many people would like them, you know, and that's now. In the fall, the University of New Mexico Press will be including Good Food, Good Health in their fall catalog. It will be for sale. And it'll be a more expanded version of this book. I'd also like to mention that our other author is R. Burciaga Valdez, PhD, who provided the medical expertise in the book. And and so we want to mention that, you know, that's also our another author on the book.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.